You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Welcome to Brookings and Falk Auditorium. I'm John Allen, General John Allen. I'm the co-director of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence. And it is a great honor for me this afternoon to have the opportunity to welcome Phil Klei to Brookings for an afternoon conversation, and with the help of some of your questions about his recent essay, Citizen Soldier, Moral Risk, and the Modern Military. First, I'd like to acknowledge his families on the front row here. We hope that these questions, in fact, will reinforce your confidence and pride in Phil. But in the event that we run hard aground up here, you're welcome to ask any questions you want, and we'll try to rectify the situation. Let me just make one comment before we get started. In the back outside, there's a table which has Phil's terrific book, Redeployment. If you've not seen it or if you've not read it, I certainly recommend it to you. It's available outside for a cost. But Phil has also said he'd be very happy to stay for a bit and to sign some of them for you. It is a superb piece of work. We have about an hour this afternoon. We started a couple minutes early, and that's never enough time. But what I'd like to do is forge on and do so by highlighting some of Phil's career highlights. He's a graduate of Dartmouth and is a veteran of the United States Marine Corps. Hoorah. As I heard from the audience. He served in Iraq's Anbar province, and I'll come back to that in a minute, from January 2007 to February 2008, and served, among other things, in the field as a staff officer, but as a public affairs officer. Coming back from Anbar, coming back from the war in Iraq, he would go on to Hunter College, where he would receive a master's in fine arts, which I think is a fantastic degree, frankly, and I wish I'd had the opportunity to do that in my life as well. But his story, Redeployment, was one of the first of his publications, and it would appear in something called Fire and Forget, Short Stories from the Long War. And he has written for the New York Times, he's written for the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, Tin House, and elsewhere. It's really important to understand just how prolific and how skillful a writer Phil is, because Redeployment won the National Book Award for Fiction. He was shortlisted on the Frank O'Connor Prize for the Frank O'Connor Prize and named a National Book Foundation 5 Under 35 honoree, and you might explain that here in a bit. In 2015, he received the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation James Webb Award for Fiction, dealing with U.S. Marines and the life in the Corps. The National Book Critics Circle John Leonard Award was the next of the awards that he's received for the best debut work in any genre. And then the American Library Association's W.Y. Boyd Literary Award for Excellence in Military Fiction, the Chautauqua Prize, and the 2015 Warwick Prize for Writing. This is a remarkable set of accomplishments for so young a writer, and it is a great pleasure and an honor to have you with us this afternoon. Phil, your essay was superb, and from my perspective, it demonstrated an uncommon, insightful understanding of some of the most fundamental aspects of the human dimension in combat, in war, and in conflict, and the inevitable aftermath that comes from this kind of a human experience, and which many of us have had to deal with in the aftermath of conflict. Your exceptional writing style, I think, added dramatically to the substance of the article. In that regard, I think you've done us all a great service by what you have written. Were I still the commanding officer at the basic school, that should send a shudder down your back, or the commandant of midshipmen at the Naval Academy, and there are some of my former midshipmen in here today, I would make it required reading for the institution, not just for the students. I'd make it required reading for the faculty as well, and we would discuss it in great detail in small group sessions. For the audience this afternoon, let me also say one thing about Phil. We had not met before this afternoon. But we both served in the Al Anbar province in Iraq in 2007 and 8, so we overlapped almost day by day in the same deployment. And I'll tell you that in the two recent wars in which the United States has been involved now since 2001, and the argument can be made that we're still, once again, fighting in Iraq and we're still involved in Afghanistan, in those two wars there was no more violent a place and no more violent a time than being in Al Anbar in 2007. And I may not know a thing about a single person or an individual person except that they served in Al Anbar in 2007, and if I learn about that, they have my respect immediately, and pretty quickly thereafter they're probably going to have my friendship. And so, Phil, it was an honor to serve with you, even though we didn't cross paths then. I know it was a very difficult time for all of us who were there. So what I'd like to do, though, is to drive on, ask some questions. We'll go for about 30 minutes up here on the stage or until we run out of steam here. And then I'd like to go to the floor and ask our guests this afternoon, and it's standing room only. If you can find a seat, you're welcome to take it. But this is an indication not just of this institution's willingness to hold this kind of an event. I think this is a direct indication of people's sense of the worth of your writing in general and the worth of your writing for this essay. So, Phil, let me just ask a few questions, and then we'll invite our friends to come in from the floor. Other than, obviously, the request of Brookings to express yourself on this issue, what caused the interest? What brought you to write this piece, please?
Well, thank you so much, first of all. It's incredible to be here at Brookings. It's an honor to be on stage with you. We never actually sort of formally met. I did once watch you deliver a speech to a group of Iraqi officers in Habaniya, and if you had told me then that one day I would be sitting on the stage with you, I would certainly not have believed it. When Brookings asked me, I'm a fiction writer. I kind of wondered if they had the wrong guy, but. Really, the essay came out of watching what is happening in Iraq now. And I think that it's something that every veteran who served there has to come to terms with in some way, because it's such a horrible catastrophe. The people there meant a lot to us, right?
Exactly right.
It's not abstract to me. I remember I was talking to a veteran who had served military intelligence, and she'd worked a lot with the Yazidi population. And when there was this sort of genocide happening, and she was reading news, she started just breaking down at her office in tears.
Yeah.
And you know, to her colleagues, they weren't unsympathetic, but it was sort of, this is Iraq, that's what happens there. And to her, no, that's not what happens there. And it's also the result of policy decisions. Not just one policy decision, but many over the course of years, some good, some bad. And so I was trying to come to terms with, how do I not just sort of make sense of this, but figure out, what do I do from here? Right? What is my relationship to this as a veteran? And what's my relationship to it as an American citizen? And asking myself those questions brought me back actually to the beginning and to the beginning of the piece, thinking about this one sergeant instructor at OCS who would ask these really different questions. When we were in inspections, you sort of, why are you here to lead Marines? All this kind of like really, rah-rah stuff. And the history lessons we got were a little bit, maybe, I remember at OCS, one of the history lessons that we received was that the U.S. involvement in Cuba early in the 20th century, that the United States was like a mama bird trying to help a baby bird fly to freedom.
Okay, romanticize.
Yeah,
okay. I'll grant that. Go ahead.
And I had never seen it, I never heard it put that way before. And then, you know, he was asking us questions, you know, like, you know, the grand contract guys, you know, you think you could order your Marines into a house where some of them are going to die,
yeah.
knowing that some of them are going to die.
Right.
And, you know, asking the air contract guys if they think they could deal with, you know, the collateral damage that might happen, women and children that they might kill inadvertently. And appreciating what he was trying to prepare us for, which was that, you know, you sign up for war. I think every young person who signs up for war, the trials that they imagine they're going to be dealing with are like, am I going to be enough of a man?
Right.
Right? And a lot of the things that are deeply important to people afterwards are deeper moral questions. And they're moral questions that don't just concern the individual, but they concern the entire society.
Your family's on the front row, and I don't think any of us who ever wore the uniform could have put that uniform on without the boost of the guidance of our families and the presence of them in our lives. With that in mind, what equipped you emotionally and intellectually and philosophically to write this piece? What were sort of the foundational elements that gave you these insights that, in my mind, you seldom see in the literature of war, and we need to see much more of it? What equipped you intellectually to write this, do you think?
I mean, as far as the, you know, my family background, the family dinner table discussions
yeah.
Would be free range. I'm one of five boys, so there's an...
Well done, Mom.
both intellectual and physical combat was a part of my upbringing. when we did McMap training, I remember, you know, the sergeant saying, you're pretty good at this.
What's McMap?
Oh, Marine Corps Martial Arts. You're pretty good at this. You do jiu-jitsu, and did you do wrestling? You're like, no. Older brothers? Yeah. But also, my family had a strong respect for service. My grandmother's here. My grandfather was a career foreign service officer. My grandmother was with him, you know, in every post. You know, actually, when I was in high school, I thought I was going to become a foreign service officer, like my granddad. My father served in the Peace Corps. You know, it's sort of strange. I'm one of three of my brothers ended up joining the military, even though neither of my parents served. But I think that the same sort of ethos and the kind of same commitment and moral questions my parents taught us to ask ourselves are part of why we joined. In a time of war. And so that's, I think, a really important part of it. And then just, you know, I Jesuit educated, and I think for me a lot of the kind of moral questions about how an individual, especially an individual within an institution, you know, reconciles himself to the moral choices that he's making and you know, the sort of your commitment to kind of the group broader than you as a whole were things that were critical to me.
That's a serious beginning. It's a serious foundation from which then you could make these unique and important observations. You know, I've had the chance in my own career to both command and lead coalitions, so I've seen a lot of different kinds internationally, a lot of different kinds of troops, soldiers, airmen, Marines, sailors. I've seen a lot of different ones. But I still come back to my own experience and my bias towards the uniqueness of the American fighting person, the individual American who today, the draft is still on when I was a youngster in uniform, who today gets up from their home and goes forth to join the service and ultimately, at least during the last 14 years or so, with a very good likelihood that they were going into combat, if not a certainty. So to me, the American individual who puts on the uniform today is still, in my own judgment, and I think it's pretty well informed, unique in the world. But you use a term in your wonderful essay, The Citizen Soldier, and it's one we've heard frequently. But you use it in, I think, a context that's really important. And could you tell us what that term means to you, and who is the citizen soldier today?
Well, I didn't think I could get away with calling it the citizen Marine. It's a term that I kind of a complicated relationship with, because on one hand, as I was going through this these questions, one of the things that I felt I had to do was, you know, if you need to get kind of situational awareness and understanding of the context in which you're operating in order to understand the choices that you make, part of that means kind of going through the history. What is the nature of this organization, its relationship to the society, and how has it changed and morphed over time? And so, there's this kind of always kind of odd tension or back and forth in the American mind between sort of like the citizen soldier ideal, the person who, kind of signs up out of, pure patriotic zeal. He's an amateur, I think of Tom Hanks' character in Saving Private Ryan, who's, competent, but he's really yearning to be the school teacher back home. Mm-hmm. Versus the professional military, which at times, has sort of been slighted, including by people like Ulysses S. Grant, which was surprising to me to see. In fact, there's a kind of pragmatic meeting place, because you need a professional corps, but one that's instilled with a kind of deep commitment to the American ideals, and that's kind of what guides you and gives what you're doing purpose and meaning in a context in which it can be just.
To that extent, of course, we've heard a lot, and we continue to hear in news coverage sometimes in news that is both good and news that is not so good about the emergence of this, of something that we call a victimization narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Our troops are inherently victims of some unfair system because they served. Do you have a sense, Phil, on where that came from? What prompted that stipulation? And in your own view, both on your own service, but also from your own service, but also from your scholarship, are our veterans acting like victims, or are they acting in some other way?
I mean, it's kind of interesting. I think it's changed over time. When I first joined the Marine Corps, I think it was a little different. We forget how things were in 2003 and 2004 and 2005. Oftentimes, I'd meet people who, find out you're a Marine. They assume that you're a badass, or, I bet you could kill me 13 times before I hit the ground, somebody told me, and I thought, probably not. And at a certain point, I realized that I kept running into people who kind of assumed I was broken. I met a guy in a bar who told me, not in like an unkind way, he just sort of wanted me to know that all Iraq vets are going to snap after 10 years, and I'd been back 3 years at that point, so I had 7 left, and I could, I should make them good ones, I guess. Part of it's coming from a good place. There are really severe challenges that a portion of the veteran population is facing, right? There's a lot of talk about PTSD, and in some ways that's very good because it's, a subject that needs study, and people who are injured should be afforded help and social recognition for the fact that they're injured and that means something. But at the same time, I'm deeply uncomfortable with this sort of notion of veterans as victims, or even this sort of assumption that if you served, it was it must have been a uniformly negative experience. Or rather, probably the dichotomy that sort of either you were like a kind of Navy SEAL superhero, or a sort of passive traumatized victim, when in fact that's not the case. A lot of people that I know loved being Marines. Most veterans do not regret the decision to join, even though they might disagree with the war that they end up serving in retrospect. And I think it's very important to think about that. I remember talking with one veteran, a Marine veteran, who actually had PTSD. And he said to me, I don't tell war stories because people only want to hear about the worst things that ever happened to me. They don't want to hear about the guys that I loved in my unit or the good times that we had or even, hell, what the biggest barracks rat I ever saw was, right? And I think that if we're going to understand the military, we need to have a much more robust way of understanding it. And I think that it's in some ways safer for us to kind of section it off. Elizabeth Sam, who teaches at West Point, says that it's easier to pathologize our veterans and take them seriously. I think that there is a victimization narrative. I think that some veterans do play into it, right? Veterans are as guilty as anybody else of contributing to false narratives sometimes. But it's one that you need to acknowledge both extremes. And also, the other important thing for me is that when there are sort of bad feelings or bitterness, a lot of times the discussion gets flattened to trauma, right? And yet, if somebody came back and feels as though, there's a line in the essay where I say, serving in the military is an act of faith. It's an act of faith that your country will use your life well. And if somebody came back and they do not feel that that's happened, their problem, they may have trauma or they may not. They may have psychological trauma or they may not. But that problem is not a problem that can be solved with a pill that will make them feel better. That feeling that they have is actually a demand to the society as part of what they may feel is Nancy Sherman talks about, a broken contract. Mm-hmm. that we need to use our soldiers and Marines, sailors and airmen better.
And that broken contract can often be nearly as traumatic as the experience in the battle space,
right,
frankly. The sense of betrayal, the sense of having been left alone after having put your soul really on the line,
yes,
as someone who has committed themselves to an ideal and a principle, which is what again makes us unique in the U.S. military. And I frankly don't agree with the victimization narrative, but it is emerging. We have folks in here who I know personally who are active duty, some who have recently left the service, some I've served with personally. But I would simply ask, if you are confronted with the victimization narrative that veterans are victims as opposed to veterans are experienced citizens, I would ask you to think very hard about that narrative. I like to ensure that I've put a lot of analysis into it before I'm willing to sign up to that victimization narrative, because I think it just gives people a buy,
mm-hmm,
and we need to not do that. You really made a profound observation in the essay, which I would ask you to talk about here. We often hear about the veteran or those in service existing at great distance from those that they serve, this gap between the civilian and the military. And in fact, in terms of percentages, we fought basically two wars. We maintained a very robust presence in the Persian Gulf, a very robust presence in East Asia, and we did all of that on the strong shoulders of the men and women who totaled roughly less than 1%, slightly less than 1% of the population of the United States. Now, when you think about how few those men and women are and how much we have asked of them over time, it's really a significant ask of this republic of its citizens, and it's really remarkable. And sometimes a lot of people worry about this gap between the military and the civilian sector. And I thought, and I'd never seen this before expressed this way, Phil, you talked about it. Could you give us your thoughts and what you discovered as you did the research on this?
Are you talking about the tail end of the essay?
Yeah, the oath of office.
Right. Yeah. It was something I discovered to a bit of chagrin. For me, one of the key things with that oath is you're not simply signing up to defend the physical security of the country, right? You're committing yourself to the ideals of the American experiment, and protect and defend against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I had that oath meant a lot to me. I think it should mean a lot to everybody who takes it. I was looking through the almanac of sort of duties for new citizens, right? There's a section on your rights if you're an American citizen, right, who's going through the process of being naturalized. And then there's a section on your obligations. And I had always sort of thought of my citizenship in terms of the rights. And right there at the very first one was to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. It's a common obligation, right? And it's an obligation that I think is picked up by many civilians, whether they're working in the military space or not, but that there's often, I think, a real common cause that veterans, when they get out and they sort of get involved in organizations, and I give a couple of examples of organizations that veterans have started, like Team Rubicon, which brings veterans to areas after natural disasters and tries to use their skills to help improve the situation. Between people working in that space and people working in other areas trying to strengthen American society and the sort of institutions that make us great. And that's the real commonality and the crucial piece, not so much whether you've, seen war or not.
When we do swear, we do swear with my own experience and the one that you described in the essay. I can remember before I deployed as a battalion commander, which would ultimately end up with me being in Sarajevo in 95, we went to the National Archive, my family, my wife and my daughters, and we went to the National Archive, and I read the Constitution for the first time, the real document in the archive. My daughters asked me, "Why are you so quiet?" And I said, for the first time in my life, because from the moment I had enlisted in 1971, I had sworn to serve the principles of the Constitution against and to protect the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, which meant willingness to expend our lives, mm-hmm. your life, my life, in that oath. And I'd never seen that document before. I was a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps. And I think that the profound observation that you made, which is that when we swear an oath to protect the Constitution of the United States, and that it is an inherent responsibility of the average citizen to protect the Constitution of the United States, then this sometimes huge gap that is attributed to the difference between the military and the civilian sector, in fact, that gap shrinks very quickly, because the vast majority of Americans may not know this. But in fact, we all are imbued by virtue of our citizenship with a requirement to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And it doesn't require that you raise your hand and put on a uniform and march off to do that. This is what Phil has made, I think, in a very profound way, made the point in your paper, that we all have obligations as citizens, not just rights, but we have profound responsibilities. And that first one, as you said, is to preserve and protect and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. What I'd like to do is to, having worried him a bit with a couple of questions, what I'd like to do is go to the floor this afternoon. We'll go for about 30 minutes. I'd ask you to, as you can, keep your questions short, but you can also make comments here, because this is not just about questioning this great writer. It's also about offering the opportunity to make your views known to us as well. We'll stop about 5 minutes out. I'll give Phil the opportunity to make any closing remarks, and I have one final question for him. So let me open the floor, please, if I may, to anyone. Yes, sir, on the aisle in the laser. We're going to bring you a microphone, and we'll ask everyone to wait until they get that microphone, please. Go ahead, sir, please.
I teach at George Mason University, and I teach ethics and national security. And I fought in Vietnam and Cambodia in 1970. Now, your essay, which I think is excellent, you raised a very difficult issue that soldiers basically delegate their moral agency to whoever happens to be in power at that time in whichever war they choose. And so basically what you're doing is agreeing to kill people, even if you think that this particular war is moral just or not moral just or wise. How do you deal with that? How should soldiers deal with that issue?
Well, I think it's not it's not a complete, you know, delegation of all moral responsibility, right? I think there's a tremendous amount of moral responsibility that the individual Marine soldier has, and particularly in the kind of wars that we've been engaged in, the kind of day-to-day questions and the moral consequences of those can be huge, right? But the crucial point is that it's not entirely on, you know, it's not up to the 18-year-old who signs up to be a Marine to ensure that, you know, a couple of years later when he's finished, you know, his training and work up for a deployment, that it's not up to him alone to ensure that he is being provided with a sort of thoughtful, sustainable military policy that will result in good outcomes, right? That is a collective responsibility, right? And for obvious reasons, he's probably going to be focused on ensuring that he can do the tasks that will allow him to behave ethically and competently within the avenues that are most available to him. He also has broader responsibilities as an American citizen, but so do we all. And I think there are many ways in which those of us back home have greater time and freedom to be able to focus on some of the big-ticket items. And one of the things that I've sort of found distressing is sort of over time people's... It's very easy if you didn't serve to kind of wash your hands of it, right? There was a kind of wonderful poll that Reason did in 2014, I think, where they asked people if they had supported or opposed the Iraq War in 2003. And they found that in 2014, a majority of Americans said that they had opposed the Iraq War in 2003, right? And which, you know, also seems to have happened to the presidential candidate. But I won't get politics. But I think that you know, when we're talking about these kind of broad global issues, I think it's really important for us to think about, you know, where is our place in it, right? Because I think it's far, far too easy for us to offload a significant portion of the moral burden of war onto that young, you know, Lance Corporal, who is already bearing the physical and emotional risks on our behalf.
Let me make a comment on this as well. There's a great book that was written, some of you, I hope, have read, called This Kind of War, by T.R. Fehrenbach. It's one of the best. And in a conversation I had with him a number of years ago, to the point that has, or the question that was asked about being asked to kill on behalf of an objective, he was specifically asked that question: how do you square that? And he said, my first view on the American service man and woman is that the Republic doesn't hire them to kill. The Republic hires them to be prepared to die for something greater than themselves, to defend the Republic. Killing may come as a direct result of that commitment, but the larger preparation, the preparation to give your life for something bigger than yourself, to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, a set of principles, not a flag, not a piece of ground, not a person, but a set of principles. Be prepared to die as opposed to go to kill for that. There's a profound difference between the two. And I think, Phil, you touched that very well in your work.
I think just to touch on that, too, you know, there's this, I think oftentimes in kind of pop culture fascination with the military, there's a fascination with kill counts, right? You know, the deadliest sniper or the most effective whatever.
Right.
Whereas within the context of the military, you know, I think of the kind of the classic example of a military hero is the guy who jumps on his hand grenade to save his buddies, right? Kills none of the enemy, dies himself, right? That heroism means sacrifice.
The gentleman in the middle, the excellent-looking tie, if I may.
Good afternoon. My name is Keith Hill. I'm with Bloomberg BNA, but I'm here as a private citizen. I heard the Army Chief of Staff talk about a month or so ago, and he said that the Army is the only branch of the service where over 50% of the 50% of its members are in the reserve and the National Guard. And that was done on purpose. Clayton Abrams, when he was Army Chief of Staff, he said that he would put the Army would be made up of the reserve and National Guard so that whenever America went to war, it would be America going to war rather than the Army going to war. My question is, what do you think of expanding that to the other branches of the service?
I don't know. I think that it's difficult to predict what'll come, but it seems that rather than the military moving towards, you know, large presence of troops in foreign countries, that we seem to be doing a lot more with less. I don't know. I think that, you know, when I was in, we were, a fraction of the country. We're still heavily engaged overseas, but, you know, we have even sort of smaller portion of that. And so it seems like the lines are going in the opposite direction, where it's, you know, ever smaller percentage of the American people operating with, you know, even less information about it to the American people. I like the idea. It sounds good. But I think that if we had that, would we be using them right now? Would it actually make a difference in terms of how we're actually engaged overseas?
That's
the general can probably answer.
It's a very good question. And it gets to the heart of, as you say, whether the Republic goes to war or do the professionals go to war. And the truth is, we do have a reserve establishment. All the services have a reserve establishment. Much of the Army's capabilities are either in the Guard or the Reserve. But even if we mobilized every single person that could go into uniform in the active Guard and Reserve, it's still 1% of the population. And so we all have to bear in mind the fact that by far the disproportionate amount of the sacrifice in uniform on behalf of the population of the United States of America is borne by a very small number of men and women. But your point is a very important one. Let me go over here. Yes, sir, on the checked shirt on the outside. I'll refrain from describing the fashions here. I'm not going to get it right no matter what I do. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, my name is Colin Roddick, Annapolis, class of 07, and current MFA student in fiction.
Hey. Fantastic. All right, welcome.
It's good to be here. In your essay, you mentioned having the privilege of seeing war as a spectator. I was a naval flight officer for 8 years in support of nuclear deterrence, so I could definitely relate to that separation from combat. It seems that currently a lot of the narratives about service are dominated, for very good reason, by combat veterans. What place, if any, do you think combat veterans have to describe, non-combat veterans have to describe their experience? Or do you think they will feel obligated somehow to, rightfully or not, to look through the lens of those who have served in a combat zone?
I mean, I actually think it's very important, right? But look, there are a lot of different aspects of you know, this sort of giant thing that we call the military that could really use more light shined on them. And I mean, certainly, like, yeah, I mean, one of my favorite works to come out of World War I is Ford Madox Ford's Parade's End, which is a series of novels that deals a lot with staff work, and he pulls it off. And I think that the experience of combat veterans is important and needs to be understood and should be understood by the broader population, because right now we're dealing with the largest return of combat veterans back into the civilian sector. And I think that it really matters what type of narratives we have that are out there about war that they can come home to, and how those narratives are going to shape those people's communities when they come home and allow them to talk about their experiences and come to terms with them. But I think that understanding the other corners of experience within the military and how they relate to what we do, because look, we're Americans and the military is a huge part of what we do as a country, and there's huge parts of the military that are not just, you know, trigger pullers, and those parts absolutely matter and shape a lot of what we do overseas and the ways that we influence. So I mean, you know, and that's one of the reasons that in my book a majority of the narrators are not combat arms.
Great.
I didn't tell anything from the wing because I don't know that much about it, but it's a gap.
Yes, sir, about halfway back.
Thank you. My name is Brian Hurley. I appreciate this session greatly. I just want to ask you a question about the issue, the flip side of victimization that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And the general used a term that sometimes I hear and cock my head a little bit sideways, and that is when we talk about the 1% who served. And sometimes that's used to wall people off from a conversation who haven't served in the military. It's a little bit of military superiority in terms of our view of our perspectives and our life experiences. And I say that as a veteran myself, but that what is your perspective on that issue of a little bit of high regard for our own service, and whether there's other ways to engage people in service that make them part of the conversation that we're having?
Right. Yeah, if you put yourself on a pedestal, it's hard to reach out and actually communicate with other human beings. I mean, I think it's as with all things, it's balance. I do think that look, the ground level of somebody joining the military is that, at the very least, they signed a piece of paper that said they were willing to risk their life for an ideal, right? That said, you know, I remember walking down the street with another Marine veteran, and we saw one of those support the troops ribbons, and he looked at me and goes, I support about 90% of the troops. Yeah, a little bit of humility can be good. And also, but I think the other crucial part is that there are people, and you know, I talked at the beginning about how formative my family's experience was to who I was and what I was and why I did what I did and why my brothers did what I did. And, you know, that there isn't necessarily a separation, and that, you know, somebody who commits themselves to the same principles in the civilian sector, they're on the same, you know, page, I think. And that's finding that common ground and respecting it is crucial.
Yes, sir.
Lou Gagliano, private citizen. First, I want to thank you for your service to this country, both of you, on keeping us safe. Having come home and spoken with other individuals who have served, how are we failing our veterans here in the United States?
Thanks, Lou. Good question.
Well, I will say there are many amazing things that we do for our veterans. That's important to realize. And I think one of the dangers, and this goes to what you say, is if we constantly have a chip on our shoulder that we're not being honored enough, or that can be a problem. I have had the opportunity to talk in various other countries, and the experience of, you know, for example, French veterans, recent modern French veterans coming back, or modern German veterans, is can be different, or the societies have maybe a different relationship to them. And I went to school on the GI Bill, and it was absolutely astounding. There are a lot of veterans who have used the opportunities that that's afforded them and gone on to do pretty remarkable things. I know a lot of them from the writer space. But in terms of, you know, areas we can improve, right? The reason I wrote this essay and my concern is kind of the ways that we have of thinking about our relationship to war, right? How do you support the vets? You take some of that responsibility on yourself. You understand that, you know, the responsibility for war, the responsibility for the consequences of war, those are your responsibilities. And then not falling into a trap of kind of easy and simplistic understandings of what the veteran experience is or what it must be or how it can be used for a particular political purpose that you like.
This gentleman just inside on the aisle. Yes. Okay. Go ahead. You got the mic with the next gentleman next, please.
Sorry about that.
I'll hand that off.
Bill Nash, retired soldier. Just a comment first.
Thank you.
I'll take advantage of that about making a comment. And I too identify with the phrase citizen soldier. But I think today we need to talk about soldier citizens. And it really carries to your point, Phil, about service after time in the military and the like. And, role, because given the small percentage and given the relative isolation, if you will, of the military, we need to have our military, our soldiers, concentrate on being citizens as well as that. Now my question, and I go back to your points of ethical and moral standards and maintaining and establishing and maintaining that, and I'd like you, and sir, I think I'd ask you also maybe to comment on the role of discipline. In combat, and we can go from a variety of examples, from My Lai to Abu Ghraib to some incidents in Anbar province that where discipline lacked and the United States embarrassed itself on the moral and ethical playing field. So would you talk about the role of discipline?
Oh, boy. There's discipline and then there's policy. If official policy is degrading and humiliating the enemy, it's not that surprising that the junior soldier will do what happened in Abu Ghraib. I think that responsibility for leadership starts at the top. And if you allow yourself to do things which are so vile that the tapes need to be destroyed afterwards because the public reaction would never bear it, what do you think is going to happen? What expectations is that going to set up among, you know, the rank and file about what is morally permissible and what's not? So I think it's not just a question of discipline at the lower level, but... accountability up top and keeping a sort of firm ethical guidelines, which become more important when we're scared and feel the urge to bend the rules for short-term gain.
There's really two kinds of discipline in the military. There's imposed discipline, and then there's self-discipline. And the very best military units, and I won't attempt to go through the various services and point them out, but when a unit is at its best, it starts by imposing discipline on individuals until they are willing to embody, to internalize the values of that organization, and then the process is animated by self-discipline. And so, yes, we have had our spate of problems where discipline broke down, but it often was less a function of the individual discipline than it was the collapse of organizational discipline. And that's where the process of accountability must ultimately hold people accountable for what they have done. But just as we've seen discipline break down in places like Haditha and other places, which I'm assuming you're referring to, I've had the chance to see the same exact kinds of discipline that broke down in one place, in fact, hold a unit together under the hammer blows of combat in another place, because those individuals had ingested the very core essence and values of that organization, and they would rather die than break faith with the man and woman on their right or their left. And that strength of self-discipline is very difficult to describe. It is, as a soldier yourself, you understand that it's something that is intangible. And I think we've all seen, many of us have seen, who've been in combat, we've seen troops that were willing to hold their fire when everything in their mind said they should be firing, yet the sense that they may harm a civilian or a non-combatant led them to discipline their willingness to fire and potentially give their very lives for that particular moment's experience in the battle space. So discipline is extraordinarily important. It is at the center, the very heart of the cohesion of an organization. It must be exemplified by the non-commissioned officers and the officers of that unit, because in the end, war is a primordial act. And as we begin to strip the veneer of civilization in layer after layer off of the troops that are in combat, it is the leadership of that organization. It is the values that that organization represents, and it is the self-discipline of the individual members of that organization that will carry it through the horrendous experience of battle. And then, frankly, when that organization comes home, if it has been well-disciplined, the amount of trauma that is suffered by those who come back from that unit is typically far less than those organizations that had inherent problems in discipline and ultimately experienced organizational failure. There's a big difference between the two, and it's not so much necessarily in combat, it's in the aftermath. That's a really important question. Thank you. There. Yes, sir. Thanks. You've got the mic.
The importance of being persistent.
Yes.
Army taught me that. I'm Steve Rout from the Code of Support Foundation, and I'm a veterans advocate. I work with vets day in and day out, and I want to ask a question related to many of the questions that have already been asked related to the subjects.
Thanks for what you're
broached.
Doing for veterans. Thank you.
Thank
for
you.
That, Steve.
It's an honor. The idea or the concept of moral conflict, internal moral indignation, related to the changing political policies and the public perception of the wars that we've participated in, as opposed to the idea of a blanket PTSD or post-traumatic stress diagnosis that's psychological versus emotional or internal. I was wondering if you could just speak to that or if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, it goes to what I was saying before, that I think, I mean, oftentimes we use PTSD as a catch-all for anything that we're uncomfortable with, right? And even something that we you know, there was a was reading a piece by the wife of a Navy SEAL whose friends seemed disturbed that her husband didn't seem more disturbed by his job, right? That, like, the, you know, it'd be kind of like easier for them if he was a basket case, right? Because they were uncomfortable with the work that he does. And I think it's important to distinguish between the two, because even though, you know, sometimes it may be that you know, one is an injury that needs to be recognized and treated, and one is, I mean, it's related to the kind of contract that we all share in as a society, and understanding where those lines of responsibility lie are kind of the first step to actually dealing with those feelings and finding out a place to move forward as a nation.
Sir, please. Could I see the hands of additional questions, because we've got just a couple minutes left? Okay. I'm going to go to the lady in the back in a moment, and then I'll come back to you. Thank you. Go ahead, sir, please.
I'll cut one of my questions in view of the... I'm Alexander Kravitz. I worked as a civilian in Iraq. So I wanted to ask about the sacrifice pick up on some of the questions before, the sort of the separation, the 1%. But what about sacrifices of the civilians on the home front? I mean, one of the things one read at the time is, you know, there was never an increase in taxes, for example, you know, to kind of make the population at large realize, look, we're all in this together. You know, we have to pay for that bill. Somebody has to pay for it. And I wonder if you could, you know, sort of comment. That's kind of a larger issue. And then a specific question. I'm just curious if you've spoken to the Marine instructor sergeant that you quoted, now that you've written the essay, and if not, whether you might want to talk to him.
Oh, God, I can't.
Great question.
I'd like to. I've got his name written down somewhere in like my old OCS like notebook. I've got a whole bunch of quotes from the sergeant instructors, some of which they might not want revisited. I'm curious what he's doing now. Great point. You're speaking to the civilians. You know, I was thinking of a guy like Cale Weston, who just did a book come out, The Mirror Test, who, you know, served with the State Department, you know, as long as anybody in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think, you know, the American public hasn't been asked to sacrifice. We haven't really even demanded that much debate in Congress over the wars. A lot of what we do is classified. It's hard to get information out. The nature of what we're doing now, a lot of it is obscured from the public view for a variety of reasons. And I think that thinking about, okay, what, you know, the way that we're waging war now is different than in the past and probably requires a new framework. There's actually a book coming out by Rosa Brooks, which I think is very smart on this, called How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, which is very much worth picking up. And thinking about how we ensure that we have a structure in place to make sure that we as a society deal with it. Not just, you know, attacks, but sort of should we still be operating on the same authorization of military force? I understand why no senator or congressman would want to vote that, you know, 10 years later they'd be the Hillary Clinton having to, you know, explain something that was popular at the time. But, you know, I think that if, you know, the policy that's not even subject to any kind of public criticism and debate is just less likely to be a rigorous and well-thought-out policy. And also, you're not going to do the work of actually getting the American people on board with what you're doing, right? It's very easy for us, if you don't like the policy, after the fact? Well, it was the president's fault. Not mine. And I think that, you know, aside from just sort of, you know, having attacks or having more National Guard units, I think there's probably a lot of ways when we look at the, you know, and I'm probably not the person to talk to about, I'm a fiction writer, okay, but there, I'm sure in this building there are people who know, and I think Rosa Brooks' book is good, but I think there's probably a lot of ways that we can look and see whether the structures that have served us in the past are serving us well for the kind of warfare that we do now, and what we can do to make sure that there is more public accountability and public buy-in to, you know, the risks that we're asking of our young men and women.
Very short amount of time left. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Jane Darby, and I'm a graduate student in Middle Eastern Studies, currently working at the Pulitzer Center. And I wanted to get back to what you said in the introduction. You introduced yourself as a fiction writer. And your book, it's tremendous. It's really, really wonderful and sort of falls into this rich literature of fiction and poetry that's been written about war that resonates both with people who have personally experienced it and with people like me who haven't. And I was wondering if you could talk about both why you decided to write about your experience and why you decided to write fiction.
Because I think that fiction allows you different tools and tools to ask the kind of questions that I wanted to ask. It's also an invitation, you know, to allow the reader to step inside the skull of another person, or 12 other people in the case of the book, and go through the kind of moral decisions that those narrators are making to... You know, it allows you to ask certain types of questions about, for example, you know, the experience of killing in different variations and in different ways. And, you know, I think when it's done right, you know, with fiction, it's assumed that it's not true. These events didn't actually happen. So the only thing that matters is getting the emotional, sort of philosophical, moral truth. That's what matters. And so you just drill down and you take things from real life. You take things from, you know, thoughts or ideas or literature that you've read or literature that you've loved in the past and try and form a narrative that allows you to get down until you've put what matters to you most about these experiences under the most amount of pressure so that you can actually find out something interesting. You know, the example that I always give is, you know, if you were to resurrect, or if there was like some sort of Encino Man situation with a veteran of the Trojan War, everybody know Encino Man? All right, yeah, I figured Brookings would be a big movie. And you know, you're like, all right, you're a veteran of the Trojan War. Here, read the Iliad. He would hate it. Right? Like, you'd be like, this guy doesn't know how we use chariots, the armor's wrong, like, I'm going to write my memoir, I'm the one who killed Achilles, you know? No easy decade. but since that poem was written down, pretty much every veteran of every war since then has read it and said, this is it. This is the truth of war. Right? And so fiction offers you tools to chase that particular truth.
Last question.
Good afternoon. Scott Cooper. I'm a retired Marine. I served on General Allen's staff in Anbar in 2007, and I am sure he would have preferred to see you more often than he saw me, as he did every day in the daily brief. Congratulations. I'm a human rights person now, and one of the things that you hint
at... Good to finally meet you in person, by the way. Thank you,
Phil. Yes.
For the work you do.
But one of the points that you hint at in the essay is this notion that when the veteran takes off his uniform, that there's a continued requirement for citizenship, of citizen engagement, which might be something a little bit new, at least for this generation or from a previous generation. And I wonder if you can talk about that, because it's something that you hint at in your essay, but I want to hear your next essay that talks about that. So,
one of the things that's really powerful about being in the military is you're with a group of people committed to something bigger than themselves. You're all, you know, you're all a part of the same, you're all moving towards the same goal. You know what you're supposed to do. You know what a good Marine is, right? We have saints in the Marine Corps. They're Medal of Honor recipients. Exemplars for you to look up to. And then I think one of the things that can be strange about the transition to the civilian world, and it can be strange even if you didn't go to war. And I've talked about this with a lot of veterans who never went to war, but found it profoundly alienating to move back into a kind of very individualistic society where there's kind of, you know, where's your place? Where's your tribe? Where's the, you know, kind of group that you can be a part of that actually, where you can do work that means something? You hope. And so it's not just that it's an obligation, but it's an opportunity, right? I think your organization's fantastic, and we talk about the broken contract and thinking about refugees in particular, translators. I think that you know, for a lot of veterans, that's one of those areas of a broken contract where we feel like we didn't live up to our obligations to some of the people who helped us out overseas.
And that's another panel we need to have. General Krulak, when he was Commandant of the Marine Corps, used to say, Marine Corps does two things for America. It wins battles, and it makes Marines. And his point when he said makes Marines wasn't about crossing the beach. It was making citizens. It is a fundamental and inherent responsibility of our services to churn out someone who served in uniform, who is ready now to be a citizen. I think that's a really important subject. Bill, could you just, my apologies to everyone here, we're over by a couple of minutes. Could you give us a couple of seconds of closing remarks? And are there a couple or two or three points from your essay, such a rich essay, that you'd like everyone to take away with them this afternoon?
Well, you know, I think that the last, you know, point that Scott made, and that is the one that I keep thinking of. You know, what's the step afterwards, right? And you know, when I was kind of writing the essay, and you know, reaching that place, it kind of broadens out and becomes no longer really just about veterans. And I think that for me, that's the most important thing. I guess that, you know, the duties of citizenship is something I'm still trying to work out. And you know, maybe you want me to write the next essay, but maybe somebody here in this room can write it for me, because it's exhausting writing these things. But yeah, that's the piece that I keep thinking of. And you know, I looked at, you know, organizations like yours that I think help show people the way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me just make one comment. The point that I tried to make, and I didn't make it very well in the question that I asked Phil, his answer is actually quite good. And the question that was generated from the middle back there about the 1%, the point is that, in fact, the obligations of Americans to the Republic are actually very similar, whether you're wearing the uniform or not. In fact, they're synonymous. And let me just read the final paragraph of Phil's essay, because, you know, we're in a moment of real political turmoil right now, and it only takes you about 5 minutes of watching each day's campaign to wonder what planet we're on, probably, in some respects. But this is really important, and it's as profound as anything I've ever read. No civilian, this is the final paragraph, no civilian can assume the moral burdens felt at a gut level by the participants in war, but all can show equal commitment to their country and an equal assumption of the obligations inherent in citizenship and an equal bias for action. Ideals are one thing. The messy business of putting them into practice is another. That means giving up any claim to moral purity. That means getting your hands dirty. I want to thank you for your time this afternoon. I want to thank you for this marvelous essay. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. My apologies for going over. And this book is available outside. Thank you very much.